Hello, everyone. I'm an Indigenous elder of the Eastern Cherokee and Muskogee tribes, and you're listening to the Awakened Underground podcast.
This podcast represents the opinions and experience of its hosts and guests for educational and informational purposes only.
Psychedelic plant medicines are sacred technologies that have been stewarded by Indigenous people around the world since before recorded history.
As these Indigenous wisdoms enter the mainstream culture, we ask you to please operate from a place of respect
and reciprocity as to end the exploitation and colonization of First Nations people.
It's imperative to use immense caution when embarking on your journey to work with psychedelic medicines,
as they are powerful tools for human transformation that are not to be taken lightly.
Information shared within this podcast should not be taken as medical advice.
Awakened Underground, its guests, and partners are not liable for any actions of your choosing.
With that said, we trust you will make responsible and ethical choices under your own free will.
What's up, gang? I'm your host, Cody Blue, and this episode's called Healing War.
This is your brain on drugs.
This is your brain on drugs.
America's public enemy number one.
To a new and dangerous area, the use of hallucinogens.
Bad trip. A bummer, a freak out, even a flip out.
Don't let drugs ruin your future.
Both call it not a war on drugs, but a war on
consciousness.
You are now entering the Awakened Underground Podcast.
Growing up as a young man in America, I always venerated the military above all else, looking up to men in arms as personal heroes of mine. My favorite video game was Call of Duty. My favorite movies were all war films, Saving Private Ryan, Black Hawk Down, Three Kings, Braveheart. Even my first independent short film was a World War II film called All That Remains. I looked up to these men and women with the highest degree of respect I could have for another person, as I viewed them as being real-life superheroes that fought and protected me and my family from all the villains in the world. Throughout my youth, I wanted to be just like them. I would often talk about wanting to join the military, in which my mother would always rebuke by saying she would cut off my big toe in my sleep. These video games, movies, TV shows, regal national anthems at sporting events, and the general masculine culture I was seeped in playing sports all my life set the mold for what a great man should and shouldn't be. This meant that I needed to be strong, brave, tough, loyal, and a skilled fighter that could always defend those who can't defend themselves and always protect my friends and family from injustice and never, ever back down. To meet this standard and earn the respect of my peers, I began training in martial arts at a young age and found myself quick to fight as a means of self-defense, with my first fight occurring at the young age of 8 on the corner of my block in front of an ice cream truck. This desire to be a great man like the war heroes in the movies turned into an unhealthy obsession by the time I was in middle school. Me and my friends began spending almost all of our free time watching street fights online and boxing each other in our backyards, training for the day we would have to fight this invisible villain the TV shows and movies had been warning us about all of our lives. My fighting days culminated at the age of 19 in my hometown of Long Island, New York. I was in a truck packed with my boys, and we had just left a party on the 4th of July when we got a call from another one of our friends who was in hysterics. Through tears, he told us that while he was waiting for a ride home, an older kid whose party we were at drunkenly walked up to him and broke a liquor bottle over his face. Now, this is at a time where we were under the drinking age, and although I was not drinking, all of my friends were, so we could not call the police and we were forced to take matters into our own hands. We quickly turned the car around and headed back to the party to help our friend, calling everyone we knew who could fight and asking them to meet us there. As we approached the house, we found our friend wandering down the street, drenched in blood and tears. We got out of the truck to check on our friend, and within minutes, a caravan of cars pulled up to the scene. Before I knew it, we were 30 people deep of some of the toughest kids I knew, rolling up to this house without a plan. Many of them wielding pipes, bats, tire irons, and God knows what else. I'd like to think I tried to talk them out of this, but honestly, I don't remember doing that, and I'm sure the reason being was probably because I didn't want them to think I was weak. I was a prisoner in a paradoxical cultural program that told me that being a great man meant that I had to be a strong man and defend my friends at all costs in these sorts of situations. When the truth is, I wasn't a man at all. I was just a boy. We all were. As we stormed into the backyard of this house, we were suddenly squaring off with an entire 4th of July party of around 100 upperclassmen from our town. Many of them are friends we were just celebrating the holiday with not even 30 minutes ago. As we were all suddenly forced to pick a side, as circumstance and social pressures pinned us against one another. Watching this unfold in slow motion, the next thing I knew, the two parties clashed, and for the first time in my life, I was standing in the middle of a brawl with no anger in my heart, an outsider looking in at this suddenly hypocritical, self-destructive concept of justice I was indoctrinated with. Unsure what to do, I clenched my fist and I punched the man closest to me. And for the first time ever, in this uncompromised state, free from the blindings of rage and righteousness, I literally felt the pain of the young man I was hitting as if I were him. It is difficult for me to describe, but as soon as I made contact with him, I literally felt his pain, fear, and sadness all at once. This empathic transmission was so strong and so profound that it froze me in my tracks. I immediately ceased fighting and began to try to break up the brawl the best I could. But at that point, it was too late, and the violence had turned to chaos, and the chaos had turned to war. That was the night I gave up fighting for good and began to practice pacifism. It was the first time ever I had experienced the concept of separate beings sharing pain as if they were one. And it was the first time the lines between the hero and the villain completely blurred, and I saw these archetypes as actually being interconnected and not separate at all. This changed my perspective on war forever. I no longer glorified war, but saw it as a tragedy. An ancient atrocity memorializing humanity's continued failure to evolve beyond the illusion of separation. A dualist paradigm that spawns all war, confusion, dissonance, and discord, perpetually pinning us against ourselves. Good and bad, right and wrong, left or right, heaven and earth, black and white, man and woman, true and false, yin and yang, one and zero, us and them. Failing to realize that the opposite of every truth is equally as true. We are one and the same and the one. We are not separate, and we never have been. To war with each other is to war with ourselves. We are two sides of the same coin, and when we come together, when we unite as one, unifying the polarities in perfect harmony, as man and woman do to make a child, we evolve to our highest potential as creators of life and the harbingers of a new world. This is the essence of one of the golden rules buried in many of the world's major religions. Love thy neighbor as thyself, because thy neighbor truly is yourself. And when we go to war, it is always with ourselves. but this is all easier said than done. But in order to create a warless world, we first must face and heal the trauma that war brings. Because trauma begets trauma. As above, so below, and as within, so without. And until we heal our internal war, we will never break these cycles of violence. Humanity has warred with itself since before recorded history, but the indelible mark it has left on the psyche of our people wasn't even clinically recognized by the medical establishment until 1980, when the term PTSD was coined, despite being the source of much controversy at the time. And it wasn't until 1992 that this revolutionary understanding of how post-trauma from an outside source can have long-lasting effects on a person deepened. As CPTSD, Complex Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder, was introduced into the psychiatric field by Dr. Judith Herman, which is similar to PTSD but even more severe, having a distinct effect on a person's identity and emotional regulation. Although these medical diagnoses did not exist until recently, we can find evidence of these symptoms littered throughout antiquity, cloaked in various aliases like shell shock, combat fatigue, combat neurosis, war neurosis, and soldier's heart. PTSD diagnoses go beyond our soldiers. They extend to their families, civilian casualties of war, and anyone who has witnessed or experienced a traumatic event such as a natural disaster, a serious accident, a terrorist act, sexual assault, threats, or violence of any kind. PTSD symptoms may include disturbing thoughts, feelings, or dreams related to the events, as well as mental or physical distress to trauma-related cues, attempts to avoid trauma-related cues, alterations in the way a person thinks and feels, and an increase in the fight-or-flight response. With the World Health Organization estimating that approximately 3.6% of the world's population are currently suffering from PTSD, which is more than 281 million people, making it the fourth most common mental health disorder in the world. In the United States, upwards of 30% of vets report their affliction of PTSD, with countless going unreported due to a culture of strength amongst veterans and the mental health stigma surrounding these mood disorders. The most common treatments for this condition is cognitive processing therapy, prolonged exposure therapy, and pharmaceutical medication. But studies into these treatments at the Veterans Association show that they are not very effective at all, and that CPT and PE only help with about 30 to 50% of its PTSD patients, with prolonged exposure therapy frequently making matters worse, exacerbating veterans' symptoms. On the pharmaceutical side, the SSRIs prescribed have an overall response rate of approximately 60% in patients with PTSD, but sadly, only 20 to 30% of patients achieve complete remission. And these medications come with a laundry list of common negative side effects, including severe liver damage, migraines, anxiety, insomnia, impotence, nausea, loss of appetite, and suicidal thoughts. With the VA only offering these limited and ineffective treatment models, we are currently losing a veteran to suicide every 65 minutes. And to add insult to injury, the government has known of miraculous medicines for treating this condition for over half a century, and has actively chosen to suppress them, making psychedelics a Schedule I substance, with President Nixon ironically weaponizing the drug war to squash anti-war protests. I am thankful to say that we are in the midst of a modern mental health revolution that is fueling the legalization and decriminalization of powerful psychedelic medicines that will change the way we treat PTSD forever. At the forefront of this pioneering model are the following psychedelic medicines: ayahuasca, ibogaine, psilocybin, DMT, San Pedro, MDMA, ketamine, and LSD. We still need a lot more clinical studies performed on many of these compounds to pin down the exact degree of efficacy. But so far, the limited studies have been a resounding success. And as far as my own personal experience goes, I have personally healed trauma working with these medicines. And sitting in circles around the world, I have witnessed countless war veterans heal themselves as well. These medicines are each unique in their own way, and many of them very challenging. I have never in all my life come across a better treatment model for healing complex trauma, or a better tool for teaching all of us how to create a warless world.
Virtually every society has ingested psychoactive substances to deal with pain, increase our energy, socialize, even commune with God.
If we incorporate psilocybin, it's supplementing therapy with a medicine that lets you find a way out of your suffering rather than just padding the cage.
Ayahuasca has been fantastically successful in getting people off harmful addictions. More than half leave completely free of their addiction, never return to it, and don't even have withdrawal symptoms.
To those of you who are naive to the effects of psychedelics, that an experience with one of these drugs can be among the most profound of the whole of your life.
On today's episode, we have the incomparable and powerful Jesse Gould, the president and founder of the Heroic Hearts Project, which is a 501c3 nonprofit that focuses on pioneering psychedelic therapies for military veterans. Jesse is a former Army Ranger that healed his PTSD working with an ancient psychedelic medicine in Peru, a sacred teacher plant formulated by the indigenous people of the Amazon basin, one of the master healer plants known as ayahuasca, one of the most powerful entheogenic medicines known to humankind. Ayahuasca is a blend of two plants, the ayahuasca vine and the chacruna leaf, which contains the hallucinogenic compound DMT. Interestingly, if you ingested the chacruna leaf normally, the DMT would be deactivated by your body's naturally occurring enzymes before going into your bloodstream. But the vine component of ayahuasca changes that and allows the DMT to cross your blood-brain barrier to grant you the experience of an ayahuasca journey. To put this in even greater perspective, the Amazon basin has over 60,000 plant species, making the discovery of this transformative combination of plants highly unlikely. Even more fascinating, that is when you ask the indigenous natives how they discover this odd combination of plants, they will respond very matter-of-factly and say that the spirit of the medicine appeared to them and instructed them on how to find each ingredient and make this powerful elixir. According to current research, ayahuasca is said to protect brain cells, stimulate neural cell growth, improve memory, and activate a protein that blocks neurodegeneration. Many studies are now proving that ayahuasca can greatly aid in treating PTSD, as well as depression, anxiety, OCD, addiction, mood disorders, and a legion of more complex illnesses. I can personally attest to this, as ayahuasca is the primary medicine responsible for the healing of my concussions, depression, anxiety, and chronic ADHD, as well as many of the illnesses that my family struggled with. On today's interview, our guest, Jesse Gould, is going to share with us his personal battle with PTSD, as well as his healing with ayahuasca. And he is also going to introduce us to the Heroic Hearts Project treatment program and even share with us a few legal, well-vetted ayahuasca retreat centers you can visit if you feel called. The Awakened Underground is a proud ambassador of the Heroic Hearts Project, and our intention in making this episode is to open a direct path for all veterans who want to work with psychedelic medicines, but might not have the means or don't know where to start. If this resonates with you, please go to the Heroic Hearts Project website and let them take you under their loving wings and usher you to the medicine that is going to be best for your unique individual healing. Jesse is a family friend, and I trust him with my life, and I ask you all to please trust him too. We made this show specifically for you. We got you. We are here now, and you are not alone, and you are not forgotten.
The Awakened Underground Podcast.
Thank you, brother, for being here. I appreciate you. I've been hearing about you for so long from my mother. So so nice to have you on, man.
Cody, thanks for having me. It's odd. It seems like even though this is the first time meeting in person, it's an inevitable event. You know, I've interacted with different members of your family for the last 5 years in different capacities. And so this is amazing that it's I'd say full circle, but it's going to continue from here. So it's not even the culmination of this.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I mean, I would love to start by, because I want to get into your project and what you do. I know your first ceremony, you met my mother. I want to hear all about that and what happened. And, you know, we are here at the Awakened Underground, we are ambassadors for Jesse's project, and we are here to help vets with PTSD, get them to the medicine. But can you give us kind of from the beginning how you got into doing this work with psychedelic medicines and vets?
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll start it off with just massive respect and appreciation to Don Howard, who passed within the last few years, but yes, he touched all of our lives in his own way, as many healers do. And it was that ceremony with your mom, and I know you've been there. Your siblings have been there.
Yes,
and many others. And again, with the synchronicity, it was the same podcast from Joe Rogan, Aubrey Marcus.
Yep.
I think we listened to probably at the same time.
Same podcast, same time. Got called to the same retreat center,
exactly.
Same year. So yep, we've been on the same wave, and finally, you know, intersecting now. It's definitely interesting, the synchronicities of all this.
Absolutely. So, I mean, I had sort of an unusual military path where actually originally I was in finance. I was in investment banking in New York for a pretty short period. I graduated with economics from Cornell University and decided to go that because everybody's going into that. And I actually loved it. But also around the time I graduated, it was 2009, so the big financial collapse, which really
right,
put into focus the good and bad sides of capitalism or just untethered greed of what that can do to a world economy. I already had sort of the inclination to go in the military. I always respected people, especially those that didn't have to and decided to sacrifice what they could potentially do for the sake of giving to others. And for whatever reason, from being very young, that always appealed to me. And so it was just one of the first times in my life where the universe just sort of aligned, where I kind of this inclination to go in the military. the financial world was collapsing. I
right,
had a financial degree. And so I was like, all right, well, it's now or never. So I decided to enlist in the military. I went through basic. This was 2010. After, like I said, working in New York, and I became an Army Ranger. So, which for those that don't know, it's a special operations unit in the military. And went through that. I was at 1st Battalion in Savannah, Georgia. And over the course of that, I did 3 combat deployments to Afghanistan.
Oh, wow.
And I was also a non-commissioned officer, which is a leadership role. So especially towards the end, I was in charge of 30 or so junior Rangers, both at home in training and overseas in combat situations, which, you know, was a very intense situation, but also, you know, beautiful for my own self-understanding and being a leader, and really has developed me since then. And so when I got out of the military, I was ready to hit the ground running. You know, I had this degree, I had this Army Ranger training. I was like, what can stop me in this world?
Right,
you know?
Right.
And so I decided to go, and eventually I did a few different things. I traveled for a little bit, eventually found my way back into finance. I was in Tampa, Florida, got a job as an international financial analyst at this big international company. And, you know, all things were good on the outside, right?
Right.
I shaped my life in the way I thought it was supposed to be shaped. And I had this great job. I was doing everything I was supposed to. I was having a social life. But little by little, the mental health issues that probably were already there for a little bit, but I was able to ignore, really started creeping in and really started affecting my life in very negative and very unavoidable sort of ways.
Right. How old were you at this time?
I had to be, that was probably 25, 26, I would say.
Mean, same age, same, like when things started to turn for me. So,
yeah. And so it was just sort of like me transitioning from this high octane life as a Ranger and then going into this corporate life where it was still very intense and really, you know, took, it was stressful and had its own sort of unique capacities. But it was different. And being in this sort of routine, I think it highlighted how unhealthy and untethered my life had become, to where I just found myself in this situation where, you know, I had to call out of work because I just wake up with so much anxiety that I was like, there's no way I can go into work right now.
Wow.
I'd wake up And my medication at that time was alcohol. And that's the only thing I kind of knew how to sort of level out the depression, the anxiety that was coming up. There just didn't really seem to be other options. But obviously that has its own downfalls. And so I'd just be there waking up and having to have a bottle of beer just to get to work and be somewhat cohesive during the time. I was fortunate. I saw the red flags. A lot of people don't see the red flags. I saw how dangerous a situation I was getting in of, you know, looking in the mirror of like, this is not normal. Why is it a Monday morning and you're having to have a bottle of beer, two bottles of beer before you go into work? Right. And I think it continued on because I was still high performing. Like, I'd go into work and knock it out and get compliments from my boss. But I just knew on the inside I was just being torn up. I was just living this unhealthy life. And oddly enough, how bad it got didn't come into full view until after all this healing journey, which we'll get into later.
Right.
But I realized now, you know, I wasn't suicidal, but I would actively put myself into situations where I could have easily died. It could have easily gone wrong. And so I wasn't suicidal, but I was indifferent whether I would survive or not.
How so? Is my uncle was similar. I think even what he got murdered, but it was more like blue suicide. Like, yeah, he almost provoked it to happen to him. Yeah,
and it's pretty common among the veteran population. It's we really tend to, you know, segment of like, oh, you're suicidal, or if you're not, then you're fine. And so I was in that other situation, and I actually had a friend who died around that time, who was in the same unit, and he died because he was from here in California, and he would just do, you know, he'd post pictures of him standing on, you know, the motorcycle seat going 80 down LA highways and stuff like that.
Damn.
And he died by a motorcycle accident just because it was that sort of like pursuit of more and just indifference to your own well-being. And there's so many people that may not qualify for that they didn't commit suicide, but they actually put themselves. And so for myself, before I went into finance, I was traveling. I actually lived in Cambodia for about a year and traveling in like Thailand and all over. And what I came to realize is it was almost this me, because of whatever was going on, because of this storm within me, it was me just like baring my chest of like, what does life have for me? You know, like what can conquer me now? And so I would just, there's times in some of the worst neighborhoods in Cambodia, which can be pretty dangerous, I would just be walking in the middle of the night just by myself, somewhat drunk. I'd purposely just like sit on a sidewalk, fall asleep. It was just this sort of like nihilism. Is this like what I felt then was like, oh, what can touch me? I'm a ranger, all this kind of stuff. But
right.
What I view now is like, what, like, you just didn't care for your life then. You didn't care if you got past that.
Is that how you identified at the time, as a nihilist?
No, like I said, it was just kind of me of like, what can touch me? But right. I found myself in this spot where, and this is pretty normal for a lot of veterans, where there's just something wrong. I was diagnosed with PTSD, but I didn't really associate with it beyond a few different things, just because PTSD has become this blanket term. And for those that don't know, post-traumatic stress disorder, generally speaking, on the most simplistic basis, happens when something very traumatic happens in your life, you know, and it's often associated with veterans because they're in combat situations and these very traumatic situations, which can cause lasting stress, lasting issues, because your brain kind of gets caught in this loop. And so there was the dynamic of, as a ranger, being in these situations where it does absolutely change your mind, and you're in these heightened stress stuff, which we can go into how much it actually physically changed your brain and the chemicals and all that kind of stuff. But there wasn't one specific traumatic event that I could relate to of like, oh yeah, that's why I have PTSD. It was just kind of more of, there's just this dark cloud around me, or this weight where I just felt that I couldn't, you know, truly be myself or truly perform, and I couldn't figure it out. But on the other side, I didn't know what the other answer was. And so fortunately, when I saw the red flags, I did actively try to change my life. I did take steps to do things. I you know, was out of shape and stuff like that, which is pretty common. Went back to the gym. I tried to limit my time going to the bar, hanging out with people that drank. I, you know, picked up cooking to have a healthy hobby.
Right.
I even went to the VA and I was just like, I don't know what's going on, but maybe I should talk to a therapist and maybe they can, you know, I've reached my end of how much I can, you know, help myself or diagnose myself. So let me reach out to a therapist. So I went through the VA process and, you know, when I went there, I saw a social worker. And to her credit, I told her, I was like, hey, this is my situation. I'm doing well. You know, I meditate pretty regularly. I journal, but I'm just reaching this limit. Like I'm still extremely anxious. I get to these very depressive spots or some spots that I'm kind of afraid of, but I'm not suicidal. Like I'm still functioning. I'm still going to be good. And she was like, you know, I don't know what to tell you. She handed me this brochure and it pretty much listed everything I was doing, you know? Right. And she was like, we can get you to see a therapist. I let her know that at that time I wasn't interested in pursuing medications. For me, that was sort of a couple steps from where I was.
Right.
And she was like, we can get you to see a therapist, but what they're going to recommend is that you're probably going to do talk therapy and medication. And if you refuse to do part of that evidence-based care, there's only so much therapy that we can give you. So it was essentially the situation where I could go there, I could probably get 4, maybe 5 sessions, but if I wasn't willing to go on medication, then that was the limit.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's super fucked up. I didn't know that.
And so that was the situation she told me. And again, to her honesty, I appreciated that. And so I was in this situation where I was like, okay, well, 4 or 5 therapy sessions is not going to get you anywhere. And, you know, for those that are curious, the reason I wasn't interested in medication and, you know, I'm not going to knock medication. Like there's a time and place and it has definitely saved lives, but I've also seen sort of the bad side of it, right? I've seen people who get on it, they get on more and more medications. It's not uncommon for veterans to be on 10 different meds, if not more. And for a lot of veterans, PTSD becomes something that you just have and they give you a protocol of how to. It's a maintenance program. It's how do you live your life despite the PTSD? And that's where the medications come in because they don't necessarily cure it for the most part, but they do for a lot of people allow you to kind of like live some semblance of your life. But for a lot of people, the reactions, it kind of makes you kind of more in this robotic mode or it takes away some of the stuff that gives you that spark of life or that creativity in life. Right. And so I understood that because I had done my research and I was like, all right, well, as bad as I am, I still have these dynamics of my life that I really like and I'm not willing to go to that spot.
Right. It's a slippery slope. You know, yeah. The person that needs an on switch needs an off switch and it starts this cycle. And yeah, I mean, and also interestingly, you and me are very similar in the sense that I tried everything before plant medicine. I was meditating, trained in TM, I was breath work, exercise, my whole diet cleaned up.
And they all help.
Everything was helpful. And that's the real crazy thing to do all of that, to kind of hit all those, check all those boxes and still feel something's not right. There's a distance, you know, there's something more to life.
Or like a weight on you that's just preventing you from being the true you.
Right. I always felt like there was a piece of cellophane in front of my eyes, like life felt distant from me, like separate. I felt isolated.
Yeah,
it was strange, man. Strange experience. So where did you go from there? Is that what pushed you to look for alternative means?
I had already a long track record of reasons to be annoyed, if not spiteful of the VA. This was just like probably one of the culminating events. And so I walked away from the situation. It was like, these are the professionals. These are the experts that are supposed to know how to help me. And so I was like, all right, well, I guess they don't even know what's going on. And again, I kind of had this dissociation with just a blanket sort of PTSD diagnosis. I was at the situation where like, what the hell? Like, there has to be some sort of path for me. It can't just be like, that's the end of the line, medication or nothing, right? And so the very fact of like acquiescing to this is just something you're going to have and you have to figure out how to maintain it was just not acceptable for me.
Right.
And I think it was just, you know, synchronicity or luck or what have you. I was just listening to podcasts and Aubrey Marcus, he was talking about his psychedelic experience. I think it was actually with Don Howard.
Spirit Quest. That's how I think, because I knew of the medicine for a minute, but that was where the first time I felt somebody presented It felt like a reliable source. You know, he took his family down as well.
Right. And it's kind of more of a entertainment value, right? Like, you listen to Aubrey, he's talking about, I think that one, he was like fighting dragons or like there's some sort of thing. He had a sword with the heart. And so I kind of listened to it more as a novelty as anything else. It was just like, cool, man. Like, that's cool you're doing this. I had no interest in psychedelics at all during that point. My only exposure to psychedelics was friends in high school that took mushrooms and like, dude, you need to try this. I talked to my cat and like he showed me this wisdom. I'm like, okay, dude. Like, it just had no dynamic that I was interested in. It just kind of fell completely in line with the propaganda you hear from the 70s of, you know.
Isn't that so interesting, just for that moment, yeah. The people that work with psychedelics recreationally and they say things like, I talked to my cat or the wall or oh, I talked to this tree. And once you actually work with like the master teacher plants and you have that sort of interface,
yeah.
How it could be misconstrued if someone was taking a psychedelic but not tapping, so they call them teacher plants, right? You have to listen. You got to tap in and be present and listen to that voice that comes through. And otherwise, if you're just socializing with your friends, you know, you're going to think it's coming through your cat. You're going to think it's coming through the television or a tree, you know, as opposed to like a voice within that you need to kind of close your eyes and tap into.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And that's kind of the hard part about psychedelics too, is that the cliche becomes a profound through psychedelics. Like, you hear people say things that sound so cliche, but because it means something different to them, or they internalize it. And I think that's part of the language that's missing right now about the talk about psychedelics. If we just say, like, everybody should love themselves, the vast majority of people are like, all right, dude, yeah, go ahead.
Right. The platitudes become trite.
Exactly. So I found myself in that situation where at first I just kind of, like, cast it off, like, had no interest in psychedelics whatsoever. But as it does, it planted that seed. You know, I think the smarter parts of my brain, the subconscious there, knew that it was sort of a do something or die or do something or whatever situation. And I think it just kind of kept it in the forebrain. And on the outside, and this is what I always try to emphasize, is I was in this situation where there really were no answers. And so I had essentially the choice between medications or alcohol. Alcohol was the medication I knew, and it was one I could somewhat regulate, not always perfectly. But at the very least, I would find myself in these situations where I'd be in my house, it'd be Friday night, right? Because of the life I was living, you know, I didn't have a good relationship. Trauma begets trauma. So if you do meet people, they're traumatized in their own way, and then it's always the
like trauma bonding.
But I just remember so distinctly, I'd just be there Friday night in my bed and just staring at the ceiling, and everything was just so gray. And I couldn't even listen to music. I couldn't even watch Netflix, just because it was so, I was beyond distraction at that point. It was just, nothing could get me out of that. And so in that situation, I had two choices. Either I could just stare at the ceiling for the whole night and just not sleep, or I could just drink until I passed out. And the preferable spot for me was drink till I passed out. And I know, like, it freaked out my family at that time because they knew I was, like, drinking a lot and stuff like that. And for me, and it wasn't that I never considered myself an alcoholic. I do consider myself an abuser of it at that time, but it was also the only thing I knew that could get me to the next day effectively.
Right. It's also such a tricky substance because it's so socially accepted.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like, it doesn't really seem like it's really easy to abuse because of that.
Yeah.
Hey gang, we'll be back with more after this quick break. And now back to our regular scheduled deprogramming. So why don't you take us to what catalyzed you to, like, the moment that you chose to journey to Spirit Quest and work with plant medicines, take that leap of faith.
Yeah, I heard about this ayahuasca thing, initially cast it off, but my brain saved it, you know, a little save file. And I think just kind of bored at work, I just kind of looked into it more and more. And I think my holdup was just our indoctrination as kids coming from this generation. It's like, if you do psychedelics, you're this kind of person. You're either like a criminal or you're a drug user, right?
Yeah, hippie, and burnout.
I didn't even like smoke pot at that time. So I didn't like, I was proud that I wasn't a drug user. Like, I classified that as a certain person. And so that was a hard wall for me to go over. And so at first I was like, oh, I'd never do that. But then I think slowly but surely the smarter parts of my brain started convincing me I'd studied abroad in college in Ecuador, so I really loved and appreciated South American culture. So then in my mind, just kind of, you know, daydream of like, oh, well, I guess if I happened to be in the jungle and a shaman appeared out of the woods and they offered me this magical potion, I would be obliged to do that, right? Like, right. Who would not? You know, this is a unique event. You kind of have to go with the flow.
Right.
And so, but I think I also realized the ridiculousness. And I was like, come on, dude. Like, you're either going to do it or not. And so I got to that point slowly but surely where it's just like, all right, well, there's not going to be this magical situation. You're either interested or you're not, so make that decision. And I think also just because the ayahuasca side didn't have that recreational aspect that I was still kind of pushing against in terms of like doing mushrooms with your friends or what have you. Whereas ayahuasca had this rich cultural sort of dynamic. It was not in any sort of way mistaken with having fun.
Right.
And so by that time, I was just like, all right, well, I'm done with this job. Like, I was afraid of leaving it, but this is going to kill me. And so I was just like, all right, hey, let me give this a shot. And again, with that luck, I've always had a strong intuition that saved my life many times. That same intuition brought me into the military and helped me seek certain understandings about myself that I was severely needing when I was that age. And at the same sort of time, it was just this sort of burning of like, this is your path. This is what you need to do. And by that time, I'd already learned to trust my intuition because it's never steered me wrong. And so I was like, all right, this is crazy. I don't know what I'm doing, but this is where my gut's leading me. So let's do it. But I also didn't tell it. Like, my family knew, obviously, I was leaving my job and going to South America. But I didn't tell anybody because I didn't want... I knew already it was a crazy enough sort of endeavor, but I didn't want to tell my parents I was going to do this mysterious psychedelic in the jungle because I didn't want that fear and all that kind of stuff. But
it's
they
tough,
did
tough phone call to make.
Yeah. And so I was like, all right, well, I told it to them. I was like, hey, I'm just not happy. They already knew that. Like, I already had spots where I'd just come home drunk and they're like, are you okay? You know? And so I was just like, hey, I just need a refresh. I'm going to South America. Fortunately, by that time, I'd had enough savings where I could make it work a little bit. So I did that. And then I did research because of that podcast. So I looked into a few spots. Some of them were very like on the touristy side of like, you do this and you can swim with dolphins and then you can do ayahuasca. And I was like, oh, that's not what I'm looking for. Whereas I think Spirit Quest, it was like a website made in the 1980s, you know, just like filled with like information, not very user-friendly, but there was an application process. Like, you had to actually apply. Don Howard actually replied to you. And I think that made the huge difference. It wasn't just like from point A to give me your credit card information. There was something more to it.
Right, because that's the tricky thing about finding a reliable source, especially with ayahuasca in Peru, because the tourism has exploded and there's, you know, so for anybody listening to this, like, be extremely discerning. That's one of the beauties of this episode is you're going to get to go into that. But so how, when you actually got to Peru in Spirit Quest, right, how did it differ from your expectations?
I think I was just kind of in this like perpetual, like, what the hell am I doing right now? Like, you don't just go from not doing drugs to doing one of the most powerful psychedelics. But everybody there was nice, you know, from getting on the boat. Anytime I go to those social situations, I tend to be a little bit standoffish until I kind of like get the feeling and flow of it. So I was just pretty standoffish from the get-go. And then they like explained it and everything like that. I was like, all right, let's do this. But it did feel safe, you know, it did feel nice. I think the moment I landed in Peru, beyond all this, I felt a sense of relief. You know, it was like just getting out of that bubble I had created for myself was relieving. And it was just trusting myself and just going into that. I was like, I don't know what this is going to lead to, you know? And so I just kind of dove into it. And, you know, when that first ceremony came, I was like, I have no idea what's going to happen, but bottoms up, let's do it, you know?
Okay, so you bought a one-way ticket, you're at Spirit Quest, you work with this medicine, and this medicine healed you?
Yeah, I'd put some cautionary parameters around this healed you sort of part because...
Helped you heal yourself.
It helped reveal some things, right? Like, it put me on the healing path.
Right.
And because I always want to be cautious of, you know, it's the psychedelics that work with you, they're a tool that you can incorporate to get you to a better spot, but it's not going to provide you all the answers. It's not going to be this magic sort of thing.
It's not a panacea. It will show you the path and you will heal yourself.
Yeah, it's not just a question of you're struggling, you go drink, and then you're better. It's a long process and it's a continuation of the process. So, I mean, like my four is, I only did the week. I think your mom did the 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And so mine was just the ayahuasca. The second week was San Pedro, but the week was all I could afford at that time and didn't want to. I felt like a week of ayahuasca was enough for me. And so the first ceremony, the first two ceremonies were just absolutely like hellish, all at war, didn't know what was going on. I considered like writing a letter to my family going into the third one because the second one just rocked my core so much. I was just like, and I still had the stigmas from the DARE program of like, is this going to make me crazy? Am I going to lose my mind?
Right. That's the thing. It's so intense. And the ego death experience itself is an experience of dying. So when you're going through this death process, I mean, from the cultural programming we have, the thoughts are, oh my God, I'm losing my mind.
I'm having allergic reaction.
I'm going to die. Yeah. I'm always going to be this way. I'm never going to go back. What am I doing? I mean, I don't know. I mean, I kicked and screamed. Those ceremonies were brutal at Spirit Quest.
And it was funny because like the second one, it was one of those things like across the board, everybody had, because that's how they designed it. Everybody just had this like world shaking thing and you'd wake up for breakfast and everybody had just seen the maker the previous night and they're all just like
the first night it's so funny because everyone there's a lightness. Everyone thinks maybe it's gonna be fun or there's gonna be something. Afterwards it's almost like coming out of battle, you know, after a few more ceremonies everyone's so light and healed, but at once you come out of your first ceremony and you go knowing you have to go back, there is a seriousness, there's a silence, there's a cloud, you know, and everyone knows this is no joke, you know,
this was not what they told me psychedelics would be.
Yeah, this
like.
Is not like the movies.
I was actually telling a funny story about your mom last night where everybody was just like rocked. And then your mom came in and she was just like, yeah, it started off pretty strong. But then I was just like, hey, ayahuasca, we're both mothers. And
I'm a mother, you're a mother. We're both mothers.
We should understand each other. You shouldn't be this fierce to me. And then she was like, And then it was just a peaceful sort of thing. I traveled and I was in space and all this kind of stuff. And all of us who had just seen like the devil were just like, you can do that. You can
do that. I had a similar experience where I got my butt kicked because someone was like, yo, it's a dance. It's not happening to you. It's happening for you. It's a communication. They're like, talk to it. And I literally was like, I literally went to my second ceremony and said, I don't really want an experience. No experience. And then I was like, everyone was purging. Everyone's going to town. I started to feel like almost FOMO. Like I want to. All right. Give me an experience, Nick. Started going, and then I was kicking and screaming again the whole time.
But it's just it's hilarious. Just like her person, like the New York personality of like, no, this is not how it's going to happen. This is how it's going to happen. And so for me, it was just like, what the hell's going on? Like, what is this? And it was like fearing for my life and all this kind of stuff. But with ayahuasca in particular, those fears are what you're trying to get over, right? Like the whole thing of like, am I going to lose my mind? Am I bordering on conscient? Like, is all this going to like pass away? Those are the fears we manifest ourselves and they're illusions, right? And so sometimes you have to see them. And that's what they say. Ayahuasca will push you to the edge, but it'll never push you past the edge. And sometimes, especially for some hard-headed veterans, we kind of need to like have our ego checked and be put to that spot. But then in that third ceremony where I was just like going into it, and I think a lot of us were like shaken taking that last one of like, if that was that hard, like I don't know what could ramp up from there. Like I don't know if I can handle it ramping up from there. And it started off and it was just as intense as the previous night. I was like, oh God. But then almost immediately when all that fear kind of came up, it was literally... Now I'm doing the Aubrey Marcus of telling you what happened, but a hand like came and reached and pulled me out, and instantly, physiologically, everything changed. Where before I was like sweating and like moving around like this and like suffocating, you know, there's like smoke everywhere. It's like the deep jungle, so it's hot, humid, you can't breathe. And then instantly, I almost felt like a cool breeze. I was just in like a tropical paradise, just completely relaxed. Like
okay, so. there is ayahuasca, the main compound in it is dimethyltryptamine. And when you work with Aya, there is a frequency change that happens. And your frequency raises so high that you begin purging. And you purge in many ways. You start sweating, coughing, vomiting. You could be going out the other end as well. And it is so uncomfortable, this frequency change. And it on a physical level, it is so uncomfortable. And there is typically a moment that happens where you sort of get kind of pulled out the other side into this lighter space where it goes from being horrific to more beautiful. And the phenomenons of what happened in that moment are more real than real life. Yeah. So what do you mean a hand grabbed you?
So for before, it was just like chaos. It was just like all the typical psychedelic things, the shapes moving around, but so intense, like just the vibrations, everything, like just couldn't handle it, just puking every single 5 minutes, right? And just not being able to hold on or anything like that, just literally trying to make it second to second. And then I saw a hand and it pulled me, and then I went through like some sort of portal, and then instantly was in a calm zone. Like all the moving shapes and sounds and everything else that was like this cacophonious sort of thing that was making me purge just all of a sudden went away. And even, like I said, physiologically, it went from me sweating and not being able to like sit still to all of a sudden just completely at peace. Like my heart rate went down, my temperature went down, I was just calm.
Right. And there's, you know, a lot of people do this work, try not to get so specific, but I like to. So in my experience, what's happening is, so when you get this kind of quintessential psychedelic fractal mandala thing, you used a great word, portal. So this, when you see these lights, it is a portal. It is a frequency. It is this spirit. There is a spirit to it, and the frequency is so high that it starts trying to attune you. It's literally an attunement process, and for me, it's almost like the density of my beliefs, whatever I'm holding on to, my traumas need to be moved for me to move into that space. And there are techniques for tapping into that portal easier. Of typically, it's not resisting it and focusing on it and surrendering and letting it sort of imbue you. And there is typically a spirit or a serpent or an old woman or a beautiful woman with vines around her that people have this experience. They call her grandmother ayahuasca, and she will meet you and pull you to sort of the other side, for lack of a better term.
Yeah.
So that's where you were. You kind of got pulled out of this denser space into this lightness. And then what happened from there?
So the self-sabotaging nature of my brain after I was there for a second was like, but what if?
Right, same.
And then just immediately went right back to the hellish. And so then through the rest of the night, it was just the learning process. And so I'd go back and forth. And, you know, you get to this exhaustion spot where you're like, all right, I'm done. I'm done with this bad stuff. Like, let me go. And that's kind of how I view it now, is almost like I view it, you know, our brain are capable of so much. And it was almost this exercise regime of like, how do you change the script in your brain? Like, especially for me that suffered from a lot of anxiety even before the military, of instead of falling into that path where your brain just feeds on itself and goes deeper and deeper into it, of when you're there, like, hey, you can change the script. Like, you can go to that peace spot. It's always within your power. And so it was teaching me through that, as crazy as that sounds, but it was like this literally through the night, it was back and forth. Like, okay, you want to go back to this spot? And then when I was like, okay, let me go there, but then I'd have to kind of stay in that sort of peaceful spot of not self-sabotaging and immediately going back. And so it was this learning process through the third, and then the fourth is still that kind of stuff. But the fourth and final, I was able to kind of stay in that zen zone, that peaceful zone for the rest of the night. And that's when, you know, some of the other like sort of profound understandings and seeing some of the negative patterns I was at, and just sort of the kind of more downloads, like life helping downloads happen, because I was able to like stay in that zone and not worry about going back. I wasn't like putting myself, and you know, there's that side of it where sometimes even if we don't think we do, we feel like we deserve that suffering, that pain.
Right. I love what you're talking about going back and forth, because I spent years doing the same thing. And when I would get pulled into that other side, call it the spirit world, call it a higher dimension of consciousness, call it your higher self, and I would bring that anxiety or that fear or that paranoia or that doubt into the space, it was almost like once I brought that in, it was like a vice grip would go over that exact energy within me. And it was like, and this is what we're here to work on.
Yep.
Lack of faith, doubt, fear, insecurity. A large part for me was surrender. I couldn't surrender. I couldn't open up to it. I was trying to control everything, right? Fear of death, you know? And so I love what you're talking about, because really within that back and forth, you start to get a real intimate, close look at your relationship with these denser energies and with death and with, you know, all this programming that is not necessarily, you know, accurate that we sort of inherit from childhood and society.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's one of those things, like, as much as I can try to explain it right now, like, it's more of a sensory thing. It's a felt sort of thing, you know, and words just don't do it justice. And so for people who've never done ayahuasca, they're gonna be like, I don't know what you're talking about. It's really one of those things that's beyond descriptions, you know. And so this is my best attempt to kind of put some sort of logic or words around it. But beyond that, it was really sort of a sensory sort of training that I was going through. And regardless of all that, one thing was absolutely apparent was this was not what people told me psychedelics were.
Yeah, same.
But also there was just a profoundness that I didn't quite understand. I still don't understand. I don't think anybody maybe really understands. But there was something to it, right? There was a reason why so many people turned to it. And just kind of a separation from that, even that sort of lesson of the back and forth and finding that Zen zone, I actually incorporated that into my life where – you know, about a year later, I was in this super anxious spot and I was with family, you know, that can be its own sort of triggering thing.
Yep.
And I was going back into that sort of childhood sort of nature of going into that anxious state where I would just, you know, feel very uncomfortable. And I remembered going into one of the peaceful spots, instantly cleared up. And
100%.
That's the first time in my life that that's ever happened.
That's actually really amazing, because it actually does give you, I mean, this is pretty complex for me to bring up, but it gives you like a mind map, an emotional mind map of these spaces that you can enter. And I do the same thing. And even in my like shamanic and spiritual practice, I will enter some of the most intense visionary states and I will immediately enter that feeling space. And it has been a great tool for healing, and I can carry that beyond ceremony. You know, and a lot of times this work used to stay in ceremony. Eventually, I think it was an ayahuasca ceremony. I was, you know, the lesson was you're always in ceremony. Life is a ceremony. It's like these rules, these metrics, these tools, they don't go out the window. Yeah. You know, you carry them with you. And I love what you said about family. So true. Eckhart Tolle has a great quote. He goes, "You think you're so enlightened? Go spend some time with your family. You tell me how enlightened you are." You know, so it really does bring up all that.
Absolutely.
Gook. Yeah. But that's amazing. I love that. So after that fourth ceremony, you did find a lot of healing and peace around your PTSD.
Absolutely. And it was nice that like the all the hardship and the lessons, like I actually learned it and was able to have kind of a more mellow and journeyistic sort of experience. And then sort of the after all that kind of stuff, you know, ayahuasca does tend to, over the many ceremonies, have almost a story arc for a lot of people. And
right.
So I did find that where it, for the most part, generally doesn't push you to the edge again on the fourth one. It kind of brings it like your cup's full, so you have enough.
It does make it, it does come full circle, and it is interesting how that medicine works. It's so intelligent. So if you have 4, 5, 6 ceremonies, let's say whatever, 2, there's going to be a beginning, middle, and an end to it. And a lot of times people get scared and they don't want to go back. But if you commit to it, stick through it, and it will all culminate exactly how it's supposed to. So yeah, it's amazing.
And again, this is me coming into it as a skeptic, right? Like this was not me like, oh yeah, let's do this. Let's talk about all this kind of stuff. So this description of it is not, you know, a person who was doing these psychedelics and had all these terms. This was literally what I felt. And then towards the end, you know, as a lot of people, I did feel lighter. I felt more at peace. I felt calmer. And one of the more notable things that I've told people, again, it's hard to explain, but on past reflection, like the way my brain felt just was vastly different. Whereas before, in comparison, it felt like my brain was just these warring states where it was just like all these things that just couldn't work together for the sake of Jesse. Whereas afterwards, it was the first time in so many years that it felt like my brain and my consciousness was actually on my side.
Right. I feel that. Yeah.
Well and said. It just felt like it was this one entity, this one unit, mind, body, and soul of like, oh, I'm here. I'm aligned now. And whatever you know, way people can interpret it. It felt like my brain just wasn't, and this was only in comparison, like I would have never said this beforehand. And that's one of those things that what I kind of mentioned before, what I've come to learn in terms of my own research. The other thing that was afflicting me, which I had to find out myself, was in the Rangers, I was a mortarman, which is a high velocity or high angle projectile bomb, essentially. So you shoot it off, and when you're a mortarman, your head's constantly around these like concussive blasts.
Oh,
because
wow.
You shoot it off and it has to like launch, you know, thousands of meters. And so your head's always like, which causes traumatic brain injury.
Oh, wow.
And so that's what we're learning now, the same as NFL players, hockey players that have CTE because of getting hit physically. Veterans are actually experiencing the same sort of thing because of door explosions, IEDs, mortars. But it's kind of more of a new sort of understanding. When I was leaving, nobody ever mentioned traumatic brain injury, but it makes perfect sense. When we had ranges where we shot a lot of mortars, we had gunners that had bloody noses coming from it that were punch drunk afterwards. And so, you know, I was not only combating just sort of the, you know, the psychological sides of my experiences, but it's also this physical element. And so it was like coupled together where the traumatic brain injury they've shown, you know, affects the hormonal balance and the inflammation of your brain, all of which perpetuates issues of depression, suicidation, anxiety. And so I think it was a lot of that where it did seem on that physical level too, it did either, you know, science is still out, but the hypothesis is lower inflammation or some sort of resetting there.
Right, right. Well, I mean, inflammation is the cause of like, what is it, most disease. I mean, you kind of know that now. And I also had concussions from football and snowboarding and jujitsu. And I went to a neuroscientist before and afterwards and eliminated them. So, I mean, I know the science is still catching up, but from empirical evidence for myself and with getting, you know, brain scans,
yeah,
it absolutely can heal CTA. Hey gang, pardon the interruption. We'll be back after a quick break from our sponsors. Sorry for the interruption. More Awakened Underground now. So after that, did you jump right into the Heroic Hearts project? Was it like that's it, this is my calling, or did you spend some time integrating after that and go back to your old life?
Some time integrating. Like, I left everything behind, like I said, so I decided to just kind of travel around. I just worked odd jobs in South America, and it was just like, what the hell just happened to me?
Right.
And it was also, you know, there really wasn't that much talk about integration or what happens afterwards with, you know, even to this day. I mean, it's kind of become a buzzword nowadays, but there really wasn't. You go to these retreats and then you're kind of on your own for the most part. Like, there's some check-ins.
Which is kind of a danger of this work.
Yeah.
Because it's like, it's hard when you have your old identity obliterated, or you're seeing the world completely different, you know, or as this subset reality. It's not the end all be all. It's this secondary component, you know, once you've interfaced with this other force or had a death experience and realized that, you know, this is just a temporary experience. It's hard to integrate. It's hard to socialize.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it's not a knock on any of the retreats. It's a capacity level. The infrastructure is just not there. We also have to understand too, and that's what we're kind of coming to terms with right now, is that, you know, ayahuasca comes from these indigenous traditions and these tribes. They work with their healers, and it's a constant sort of check-in with the tribe. And
right.
Oftentimes ayahuasca is not even used in the traditional sense.
Right.
We're coming from a Western mentality where we don't do any work for 30 or 40 years and then all of a sudden have to have these huge experiences where it's just like, oh, this is childhood trauma, and then this happened after that.
Right.
And so it's a different, and we're more geared towards having this connection with a therapist or what have you, talking about it, very much focused in the logic part of our brains.
Right. And for me, those medicines are more integrated into those societies. So, it, you know, there is a language established. Like for me, I'd go to, you know, I think the most traumatizing thing was coming home to tell family and friends, I just had this life-changing experience that was more real than real life that changed me, and being feeling judged or unseen or sort of written off like as it was a hallucination. And it actually caused me to isolate a bit more. It gave me a bit of a social anxiety and a shame around, you know, what was now you know, part of my identity and being, you know, it's definitely tough. So I'm really appreciative that you're touching on this part of it, because no one really talks about it.
And like we said, and this comes up all the time in this conversation, it's beyond words. The buzzword is ineffable, right?
Yeah, ineffable, yeah.
And so if somebody hasn't experienced it, it's nearly impossible. What I always say is you can academically tell somebody how to swim, but until they go into the water, they won't know what the hell you're talking about, right? Like there's no way for me to logically explain to you how to swim if you've never experienced water or anything like that.
Right, right. I also think there's a lot of implications for people when you talk about this thing. I mean, one, it sounds scary.
Yeah.
It's like, also, it's sort of like, you know, it's you either are going to believe this person and take them at their word, or you're going to change a lot of your own beliefs and identity to let in this new paradigm of understanding reality. And a lot of times it's much easier to be like, it was a hallucination. That was them, you know?
Discount it, yeah.
Yeah, discount it, especially because these medicines are so intelligent. They meet everyone where they are. If you are a Buddhist, they will use Buddhist terminology and visuals. If you're a Christian, they will do the same thing. If you're into science, they will use that. I've held space for a mushroom ceremony for someone who's a secular scientific person. I would categorize him as a bit nerdy. And I watched there, sat, you know, bedside as they were using Rick and Morty to explain the portal to him. And I'm going, and he's laughing. And I go, what's going on? He goes, they're showing me the Rick and Morty portal, and they're explaining what's going on using a game called Rifts, a role-playing game, which a Rift is an interdimensional portal in this old role-playing game. And he's getting explained Rifts. It's a Rift. It's a portal. They're showing visuals. And that is, it's sort of this spiritual Pictionary. You know, it's depending on where you are in your process depends how clear the channel of communication is. So if like, if you don't understand that you're being communicated to, it's sort of like doing this work, sort of like, especially if you're holding space or a guardian, it's like being a death doula. You know, you're sort of holding space as they connect with whoever's on the other side of the simulation, whatever you want to call it, your ancestors, your guides, spirit, God, call whatever you want. And you're sort of holding space for this interaction. And if they're scared by it, or they think demons, or it's a hallucination, they're not going to process that there's a very clear communication happening.
Yeah.
And one of the great things about having someone like yourself, a liaison, same with the show, is you can sort of prep people and let them know, like, that's what's happening. So if people or beings or something starts talking to you, listen to what it's saying and don't, you know, I used to talk a lot of shit. I'd argue with it. I'd ignore it. I'd laugh at it. Now I'm like, okay, like, what do you got for me? Like, you know, school's out. Tell me. Amazing. So
absolutely. So, and that's part of the reason why we think it's so effective, is because that's always the hard part with traditional talk therapy, is that it's somebody else that comes from a different walk of life trying to use words and come to this commonality of you overcoming your trauma or understanding your trauma, whereas the psychedelic works with you in only the way that you understand and puts it to you in, especially ayahuasca, and these sort of, it might not be direct, it might not be like this is actually the trauma, but it's metaphorical in a way that only you would understand.
Exactly.
Whether it's Rick and Morty or a religious sort of dynamic.
Exactly. I love it. It truly does meet you where you are, and that's why it's like and ineffable, call it whatever you want. It is such an advanced ancient technology, and that is there is no ends, ifs, or buts about it when you're actually directly communicating with this.
Yep.
It is truly humbling.
Yep.
Humbling.
And it needs to be, because like myself, we're hard-headed. You need to have some humility for it. We in Western society, our egos are so built up because that's all we feed. That's all we incorporate. We don't connect to our emotional centers. We don't connect to our unconscious. And so it's these voices these places in our brains that the trauma is stored. That's where we compartmentalize it, but we don't give it an ability or a language to come out.
Right.
We just only work in the logic center. We only work in the ego center. And the psychedelic is almost what I say to people, like a Google Translate, where finally you understand, you interpret what your subconscious is trying to tell you. Because if you don't have that, the trauma manifests in, you know, health issues or outbursts or what have you. That's all it coming out, trying to like tell you like, hey, there's a problem here.
Right. Dissolving those barriers between the conscious mind and the subconscious mind are a big part of what it does. And once you start to get through those barriers, it puts you in more of that dream state, that flow state, that creative state of consciousness, where you're more in flow and you're not trying to control with your rational mind. You're more along for the ride instead of trying to dictate where the ride's going. Amazing. Okay. So tell us, so take me to the inception version of Heroic Hearts. Yeah.
So bouncing around and just trying to like, what the hell just happened? You know, I had my own false steps just because, like I said, there really was no infrastructure there and all this other kind of stuff. But I also came from a veteran community where by that time I already had people I served with that had unfortunately taken their own life, or a lot of people I knew that were kind of in similar situations actively taking their life. And a lot of the, you know, it was just, it started getting into double digits of people that I had lost at that point. I was like, hey, I have no idea what this is, and I don't necessarily think it's for everybody, but the people I serve with at least have the right to know that there's other things out there.
Right, but there's and another option.
It's really that sort of basic premise of like, I just stumbled upon this, you know, randomly in my own life, and it's a little bit weird, but I would have appreciated somebody else telling me like, hey, if you're at your rope's end, maybe look into this. If it's for you, if it's not for you, whatever. So I actually like talked to friends that were still in and all this kind of stuff. Like, hey, I just did this. Is this crazy? And like, yeah, kind of. But like the military mentality really, really is like, you can plan. And we do these whole like op orders. But at the end of the day, as much as you plan, the situation changes on the battlefront. And all your training is about reacting to the change, right? And so it's really much of like, you don't always have the tools you want. And so it's using the tools on the ground and what's around you. And so I do think a lot of military minds are like, okay, well, if you say it works and it's for some people, then why not, right? Like if it's another thing that people can explore. And so that kind of got me into it and had no idea about nonprofit, but was like, hey, I just stumbled upon this. I think I have the skills that I can make this kind of work. So I'm somewhat obligated to at least give it a shot. And I was in the middle of nowhere in Columbia, a small town, in an internet cafe that had power, you know, only part of the day. And there I was on like LegalZoom of like, how do you start a nonprofit? How do you make a website? And so literally from that, I just, you know, did it step by step, made a website, went on LegalZoom, got the whole nonprofit thing started. And just from there, it really took a life of its own. I did that, reached out. And then again, another term that people who aren't in this work are going to kind of like have a little bit of a pushback on. But the synchronicity is the moment I started it and the moment I kind of aligned with that, the right people just came into my life at the right time.
There's definitely something synchronicity. I know it's a little like woo, but at the same time, there's this paradoxical question around free will versus fate that we're always kind of talking about. And, you know, as all things, you know, the opposite of every truth is equally as true. Both things are true. We have our free will, but also when you align with your path, things seem to just click.
Flow state. You know, there's flow a lot state. Of exactly. popular with athlete performance and all that kind of the same kind of stuff.
That's like, what it is. It's being in a flow state.
And yes. When you're passionate about something. And so I started it and literally within a couple months, like met the right person, was able to actually sponsor a first veteran retreat in Peru. And so from there, you know, the main objectives, like I said, one, educate. And like any other sort of group, speaking to veterans, there's a very specific way to speak to them, right? Like it's going to be more direct. You know, if you're talking to a scientist or if you're talking to a tradesman, you know, somebody within that group is going to be better able to speak to them than
right.
somebody outside.
100%.
Like you. And so it's the same sort of thing of veterans of like, obviously psychedelics really weren't on the menu of veterans. So like, how do I present it to them? And because there really wasn't anything else, there was no other veteran organization that was presenting this to the veteran population. So I was like, okay, how do we be direct about this? And then also facilitate. Like I said, there's a lot of things that I felt were lacking in my going. Fortunately, I was comfortable with traveling internationally, but you know, anybody else could have arrived in Peru and all sorts of disasters could have happened. You hear about it all the time of just going to a shaman that's, you know, picks you up from a random spot of Iquitos. And so that was the whole point of the program of from what I knew and what I was lacking, let's build a container of support for those that are same sort of that were in the same spot that I was at. So it's not, and we've never been in a spot of like, hey, everybody should take ayahuasca, everybody should take psychedelics. It's never been that. But it's always been, hey, if you are interested in this, if you're looking into this, then we can help you. You know, like it has to be your decision. But if this is the path you're going, one, we're going to show you that there's other options and how to do it. And then two, if you do decide, we'll do our best to support you there. So that's kind of what we created since then. Really one of the first veteran programs where people come to us, we do a basic intake of, you know, and this is really harm reduction. So we're not prescribing anything. We're not saying you should do this. But people who are already inclined to go to psychedelics, we'll take them in and we'll say like, hey, you know, like figure out where they're at, make sure that it's safe for them. You know, if they're going to ayahuasca and they're on five different medications, maybe pump the brakes on that.
I always think that's the most ironic thing in the world, that one of the greatest contraindication for doing work with plant medicines is pharmaceuticals.
Yeah, SSRIs and SNRIs. Yeah.
Also, though, because while we're there, we should stay high blood pressure.
Yep.
Heart problems.
Major physical stuff, so like recent surgery, heart problems, history of psychosis, family history of psychosis.
Okay, you gotta, can we talk about this a little bit?
Absolutely.
Okay, because this is the tough thing for me, and it's such a tough thing because we're in this legal paradigm where we have to, you know, protect ourselves and we don't want to risk hurting anyone, especially as these are integrated in the West. I would hope if there was anything in the world for something like schizophrenia, I would, which is to me is like the most problematic issue. If there was anything, I would think it would be something like ayahuasca, but that is a non-starter. If you have schizophrenia or mental health issues, or can you talk about that line between if you have mental health problems versus, you know, if it can help you or if it, like, where's the line there for mental health and working with psychedelics?
Unfortunately, it's very tricky, just because even our own understanding of mental health is just very rudimentary at this point. And so, like I said, like PTSD is a blanket term that can mean all sorts of different things. Bipolar is it's a little bit more specific, but there's a lot of different cases of bipolar. And so there have been people that helped, but most retreat centers will not work with people who are bipolar. I do think as we learn more about psychedelics and a little bit more understanding of how they work, I think it will start opening up. But even there was, I think in the 70s, there was some research of there's different types of schizophrenia. So there are some people that have schizophrenia and they almost have like a perpetual psychedelic state.
Yes.
And then there's some people that have schizophrenia that's kind of more of the multiple personalities, right? And they actually showed that with the perpetual psychedelic state, LSD actually potentially helped those people, but the multiple personalities, that was kind of that made it worse.
Hey gang, pardon the interruption. We'll be back after a quick break from our sponsors. Sorry for the interruption. More Awakened Underground now. Well, I mean, look, I could go deep in this off ramp. I don't want to take us too off center, but so it's so fascinating to me, right? So, all right, 99.9% of the electromagnetic spectrum we do not perceive. Same, 99.9% of the acoustic spectrum we do not hear. So, right, we're perceiving 0.001% of what's going on, right? On a perceptual level. We know we use so little of our brain, all of that. When you work with these medicines, especially something like, let's call it a daytime medicine, right? So, let's say psilocybin or Wachuma, right? You immediately start to see things like more of reality, let's say. You start seeing more of reality, using more of your brain, and we've seen something like psilocybin actually creates more neural connections at different parts of your brain, right? So yep. We know that scientifically we are using more of our brain. And when you enter these shamanic states of consciousness, let's call it, you have things like people around you. It's almost as if you're in heaven and we just can't perceive it. We're perceiving this illusion of separation in this dense world, right? So when you start to, you really do a lot of this work and you start to perceive more of reality, you start to see things like ancestors around you, or you know, maybe a deceased loved one or whatever, who will be in the space as real as you sitting here right with me right now, right? I've seen people with schizophrenia, let's say on the internet, make videos of this is what it's like, me walking around and these people around. Yeah. It's very much a shamanic state of consciousness. And it's really confusing. And I'm like, wait, do they just have a predisposition to this type of work?
Right. At the very least, I think the way psychedelics interact with their brain, I think will unlock untold amount of understanding and appreciation of some of the mechanisms of the brain. And so maybe it'll help us understand that and work better with people that have those issues with mental health.
It's so interesting though. Like I was someone that had a very, let's say, like busy mind, and I found more stillness. Yeah. I actually am always more nervous for people I know who are very square or rational, like atypical people. I feel like they're gonna have the hardest time letting go.
Yeah.
You know, and going through my journey and finding out that ADHD was a bit more of an openness to the subtler energies and leading me down this path of working with plant medicine. things. It makes me wonder if people who are schizophrenic are potentially, you know, more inclined to a shamanic state of consciousness or mediumship. I know in some indigenous cultures, schizophrenia takes on a more playful energy. They actually have a lot more childlike nature, and it's not as aggressive as we see in our society. Yeah. And I'm wondering, how much is it that we just don't have any of the infrastructure for those types of people who are dealing with schizophrenia to be integrated into society? You know, they're ostracized. There's a shame component that comes with it, you know. So I've always wondered if this medicine would be good for them, even though it's one of the main non-starters.
Our knowledge of it's still early. So we do have to make limits. Like, it is still risky potential. And the way we kind of assess it right now is, if you view sort of a psychedelic as somewhat of a chaos factor, people who already have a lot of chaos in their brain, it might not be the best fit for them immediately, because then that adds to it. People who have relatively like stable brains and all that kind of stuff, some chaos can actually be a good thing. It can actually like shake up sort of patterns and all that kind of stuff. So sort of on a very rudimentary basis, that's kind of where we do it. Like, if somebody's actively suicidal, then a very powerful hallucinogenic, as far as we know right now, I wouldn't necessarily recommend or put them there. There's other tools available right now. And so that's kind of where we have to kind of, with the limited infrastructure that we're working with, we have to still be as conscientious as possible and keep it within a certain spectrum of people that are seeking our help.
So you just went through the origin of Heroic Hearts.
Yeah.
So can you talk about some of the programs you have going on and what you do, how you organize and orchestrate your programs?
Yeah, absolutely. And so, yeah, the program itself, you know, we generally start about 4 to 6 weeks before. It's a whole preparation course involving mindfulness and breath work. And that's really what we try to emphasize. The psychedelic is a very powerful part of it, but it's just the start of your healing journey, right? Like, you do need to have discipline and prepare for it. The more prepared you are with just getting your mind in that right set, with intention, with diet, the better it's going to happen. The more deep you're going to go, the more you're going to get out of it. The same with the afterwards, this word integration. You might have pretty profound insights, but if you don't incorporate that into your life, if you don't make positive changes, it's going to be limited in its actual effectiveness long term. So that's what our program is designed around, where the psychedelic is there, but we have this course of preparation. All the retreat centers that we use, we vetted just to make sure it's aligned with how we work and that people can assure safety. And then the aftercare in terms of following up. We have individual coaching, which are also veterans, group therapy, and then community building. And so that's sort of the mainline program. Ayahuasca has been and always will be the center. It's a very powerful healer. But there's all sorts of other psychedelics that all have their messages, all have their time and place. Like we said, some people who have certain medications might not fit with ayahuasca, but there's other things. Ketamine-assisted psychotherapy in the future, possibly MDMA therapy. Psilocybin is sort of a great grounder. It can be a great sort of continual resetter or teacher. And so we've incorporated all of these depending on where the person's at in their healing journey versus a specific diagnosis. And so that's sort of our mainline program. People come to us. We don't diagnose, but we do, like I said, harm reduce, and then allow the person to sort of feel what fits within their path, and really enforcing their trust in themselves. They're listening to their intuition that they are actually the ones that can heal themselves. They don't need anybody else. They can work with a psychedelic and figure out ways to heal themselves as long as they have the right tools and support network. So beyond that, we've done some research and some policy. So most of the states that you're seeing that are doing some sort of drug policy changes, decriminalization, or research bills, we've generally been a part of in some sort of capacity, just to kind of help move this forward and increase hopefully future accessibility on the local level. Because at the end of the day, community is the key to all this.
Right.
And then beyond that, we've done research. So we're fortunate to partner with University of Texas Austin, which is doing a very comprehensive psychedelic study. And it's exciting because it's Texas, right? Like, the Texas psychedelics, we don't associate that. But University of Texas, Dell Medical School, is the first psychedelic center in Texas and one of the first in the country. And so they're doing a study with psilocybin with wives that have lost spouses in the military.
Oh, wow.
So the family support dynamic. ayahuasca with veterans, and Ibogaine with special operations veterans. We've also worked with University of Georgia. We developed a study with Imperial College of London, which is one of the foremost experts in psilocybin. And that one's interesting because it's one of the first psilocybin studies focusing on veterans with traumatic brain injury. So most of the psychedelic research, like the MDMA trials, are focused on psychological issues like PTSD, depression, addiction. But there hasn't really been many that are focusing on the physical elements. Like, do psychedelics actually heal the brain on a physical side? And we believe yes.
You haven't done any studies with this yet?
We're starting it. So we finished the protocol, and so now we're in sort of fundraising capacity. And so we're going to do cohorts in Jamaica of veterans that have traumatic brain injury, and they're going to go through psilocybin sessions, and then we're going to test and measure what physical effects does it actually have on those veterans.
Are you going to get brain scans before and after?
Brain scans, not right now. We're going to do EEGs. And yeah. Then there's another sort of test that you can figure out like what's going on in the brain just by how their reactivity to certain things, as well as the psychological side. We want to do brain scans in the future, but they're just very cost prohibitive.
Right.
At the end of the day, our main program is helping veterans. And that's where we fit in, is that all of these veterans have fallen through the cracks of the current system. They all have come to the spot where they're just out of necessity, they need something because the VA has essentially failed them. And so, you know, we love the clinical trials, like what MAPS is doing is amazing, but there are thousands, if not tens of thousands of people right now that don't have the ability to wait 5 years. They don't have the ability to even wait 1 year for the FDA to get its act together, for politicians to get their act together.
Right, right. Vets commit suicide every 65 minutes?
Yeah, something. I mean, the specific statistic is hard, but it's gone everywhere from 17 to even 33 was the last. Regardless, none of it's acceptable. And despite hundreds of billions of dollars gone to the VA, the suicide rate has only gone up. Right. So there's obviously holes in the system. And so that's our main purpose. We are on the front lines of this. And every day we get veterans with the saddest stories that are just struggling, and they want to survive. They want to be alive. They want to be there for their family, but they're losing that battle because there is no infrastructure for it. And there's nobody listening to them. As much as politicians say they are, they absolutely are not.
There's an urgency.
There's absolutely urgency.
And that's something with this work, is that's why it's so important. That's why people like us are not waiting for the law to catch up with this, or the science to catch, take it into our own hands and trying to push the ball forward. I would love, and that's one of the things with this, is I want to give people as much information they have possible in case they want to embark on this journey.
Yep.
I would love to kind of go through a bit of your process. Can you go through your prep, what that is like, including the dieta, in case anybody would says, hey, I don't know where I'm going to go, yeah, but I would love to start the dieta. So as soon as I find a place I trust, or as soon as this becomes legal where I live, or I can afford it, I'm there. Could you walk through the prep and the diet?
Yeah, and absolutely. And I want to emphasize too, like, even though we're essentially on the front lines, there's absolutely no infrastructure, we are doing as much as we can to build as safe of a program outside of the system as possible. And our network is huge in terms of some of the most impressive researchers, academics, practitioners, therapists. So we are building this infrastructure where there really wasn't anything. So it's not just this renegade, you know, come to my basement and do this. You know, we're making sure that, you know, we're doing as much safety precautions as much as possible, because the last thing I want to do is do more harm to anybody.
What you're doing, from everything from precautions to research to documenting everything you're doing to help put the push not only the science but also the legislation forward. I mean, you're dotting all the I's and crossing all the T's, and the best of any organization I've seen, especially for vets, are as good. So I mean, I like could not respect and trust what you're doing more. And that's why I'm really looking for you to give us a little more detail on those steps. I think it will be insightful for all the listeners.
Absolutely. And so coming into it, like I said, we do the basic intake, which is health checks and what medications are on. Let's say the person gets the green light. We also make sure that they're fitting in our program. We don't want people that just like want to casually go into this. We don't want people looking for a magic pill. We want people who are going to do the work and go into it. So the preparation, like I said, we generally start about 4 to 6 weeks before.
Nice.
That month before gets them in that right mindset. It's almost like a deployment where they're getting their head in that brain space. It gives them time to, we have integration coaches. They talk with them. They talk about intention of like, what are you looking for in this? What are you looking to explore? Generally about the four week mark is the dieta that you mentioned. And so with these medicines, you want to start eating healthier. You have to take out stuff like alcohol, caffeine, cannabis. All these things can prevent you from really going deep. All these things can vie for sort of the attention. The cleaner you go into it, the more profound the experience is going to be, the smoother the experience is going to be. So we cover that. And
do you cut out sex? Do you have them cut out sex too?
At least 2 weeks before.
They always say ayahuasca is a jealous lover.
But then also social media, right? And like all these things, it's not only diet of what you eat, it's also what you're taking in. Social media, news, the retreat centers we generally use have a no technology policy, so at least they're going to be isolated there.
I love that. You are what you eat, and that includes who you hang out with and what you watch and the music you listen to and everything.
So all of that, they talk to their coaches. The coaches help guide them, and they're veterans as well. So they have that peer support sort of system. And then we have a course that was done by our friends who do men talking mindfulness, and they create a mindfulness and breathwork course so they can go to that. We send them surveys to do the research. The retreat centers we do, it's more trauma-based kind of work, so more intense ayahuasca ceremonies as opposed to like a Santo Daime, which does kind of more communal sort of stuff. So
you do individual?
No, we do group work. So
you're saying the dose, it's more of a, not a micro dose, it's more of a macro dose.
It's more of a macro dose and then multiple ceremonies. So you go in, take the dose, you're in it for 4 to 5 hours, and then you do integration talks the next day, and then you go into it, and then...
Do you do what Don Howard used to do, where he'd space it out a day, or do you go back to back?
Depends on it. So some we do 7-day ones, and we do two. So two back to back, a space, two.
Nice.
We've done other ones that are kind of more compact. Again, it depends on the group.
And how many rounds do you do? Do you go 3 to 5?
3 to 4.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. Okay. Okay. So now that we're at this point in the process that I'm having you get granular for our audiences, what retreat centers do you use? Because I know you personally vet them, and it is really difficult. And people like look to me, where do I go? And I'm like, I'm working on it. But that's also kind of risky, you know, and everyone has to, you know, act on their own free will. But do you have some retreat centers if people are desperate and suicidal and not doing well that you could recommend that you vetted? Because Don, I never know anymore about Spirit Quest because Don Howard's passed, even though Don Robert is amazing. His daughter, I really trust them.
I haven't been back there, so it's hard for me to speak to.
So that's why I can't recommend it.
We actually are moving kind of more. We do have a few, and I'll list them. It's a cautionary tale, just because they'll have new facilitators, they'll have new sort of practices, and so it's always hard to blanket recommend.
Yes.
So what I recommend to people is do your own research, like follow the recommendations, but always do your own due diligence. But what we are kind of moving more into a model is just finding the healers that we trust, and then organizing things with them, as opposed to, because the commercial retreats, they're catering to a certain audience, where we're catering to people that it's a little bit more intense experience, and we want them to be comfortable. So, I mean, again, take this with a grain of salt. In Peru, Temple of the Way of Light is always sort of the standard bearer. We work with a place called La Medicina. It's under new ownership now, but it's now they're working a lot with Soltara. Soltara, I think, is a good spot. They and it's not only the medicine work, but also, you know, what I appreciate about Soltara is that they respect the indigenous traditions. They teach about the indigenous traditions. I think all of that should be preserved, and just not to appropriate it to where it's like, this is ours, you know, like, where does this come from? Let's respect the technology. These healers want to work with us. So those are some of the big ones that we work
with. Can you say those one more time, just in case anyone?
Temple of the Way of Light, yep. La Medicina in Peru, Soltara in Costa Rica is a great one.
Perfect. And this is mostly for ayahuasca. Do they do Huachuma, Bufo, or any Vilca?
No,
we
try to keep it like pretty key on the ayah.
Do you have any mushroom spaces, people, if they want a little lighter medicine to start?
So we're starting to work with Beckley Retreats. It's a pretty new one in Jamaica.
Nice.
And so that's part of the Beckley sort of group. And, you know, Amanda Fielding is the one that founded that. And so she's been one of the lead figureheads of psilocybin and psychedelics for a while. And so they have this whole cohort there.
Nice. And then can you take us to, now that you've taken us to where to go, can you talk about your post process, your integration process?
Yeah. So the integration process, we start that at the retreat. You talk about it of like, hey, this is a window. And if you go right back to your old habits, then a lot of the old issues are going to come back. So one of the main things is, like I said, we have the veteran coaches that follow up with them and have one-on-one sessions. We continue to have group sessions to keep that group cohesion. And then that way they always have a space every month that they can go to for as long as possible. But then it's really just the tips and tricks and giving them as many tools as possible. I can say meditate, but if it's not your thing or you're not there yet, then it's just going to go out the window. But we can give them tools. We teach them about meditation, breath work, yoga. We're working with a company called Homecoming that's doing a digital app that can kind of remind people of like, hey, have you done this breath work? How are you feeling today? So I think the technological sort of integration with this is key, because we're so on our phones of like just having that maybe a little reminder. And so that's really the tricky spot. But I think at the end of the day, what we're really going to focus on is localized community basis, because that's the failure across the board in terms of integration, is that most people, including ourselves, have this sort of checklist of what you can do. But if the people don't have an accountability or a support system on a local basis, a lot of it's going to fall out the window, or it's just going to be dependent on personal determination. And so really what we want to do as Heroic Hearts is help the local community build their own infrastructure, have their local guides, have their local people, you know, down the line when laws change, maybe local psilocybin ceremonies. But that way a veteran can check in, can have coffee with somebody and have that accountability. And that is the absolute key.
Right. Accountability buddies are so important. I'm really curious what you have witnessed. I know it's, it can be touchy. What have you witnessed empirically, people healing, working through, you know, your program?
Again, it changed, you know, it's a spectrum sort of thing, but we've been fortunate enough to where nearly everybody that we've worked with, we haven't had like people say like, oh, F this program, I'd never do this. On the low side, it's just people who may not get as much of a powerful sort of thing, or they may kind of like kind of go back, you know, hide back into some of the old traumas. But on the upside, which is the vast majority of cases, and everybody says like, at the very least, this moment, this experience gave them new tools or gave them a new perspective on their life. So it gave them something at the very least. On the high end, complete sort of transformation. You know, the story I like to tell is Rudy, who was a Green Beret. You know, he went into it just sort of that like intimidating veteran, like huge dude, man of few words, came out of it kind of like his pre-military goofy self. And he's telling me a story of just how it changed his interaction with his son, where before the son knew this sort of like by the book, very regimented, cold figure. And then afterwards is this goofy guy that was making pancakes with him and joking around. And that is also the importance of this work. It's generational. It has much bigger ripples than just the individual.
Right. The way these illnesses like depression or PTSD or bipolar disorder, they don't just affect the individual. They ripple out into the family structure, and that ripples out into how all of those people show up in the world.
Yeah.
And affects society on a whole.
And that's why we also work with another organization called the Hope Project, where they work with the spouses of these veterans. So they give them coaching and access. So then that way there's that built-in support network where, because trauma is not just by yourself. If you're living with a veteran that's gone through PTSD, you're going to have your own residual PTSD as well. And so the Hope Project, led by Allison Wilson, has also been doing amazing stuff to help that side of it. And so it's really this, there's so many different great organizations out there, and how can we work together to build the full picture that people need? And, you know, we are focused on veterans, but this is going to have, this is going to help dynamics of beyond that. Like every civilian could benefit from not even psychedelic based, but just a better mental health structure, infrastructure, support network. And so we're hoping that by this example, the veterans can create that can really help other communities, other families, other units.
I love it. And can you talk about, just you touched upon it, but where we are politically in terms of people want to be advocates for legalization, decriminalization, access, education, scientific studies, anything that you touched upon it that you're doing or that people can do to support this movement when it comes to the politics of it?
Yeah, absolutely. And most states have some sort of bill that's looking into this at some point. Some are a little bit more advanced, like Oregon. In California, there's the SB 519 that's currently active. So I'd just say go to your local, most communities have a, or most states have a psychedelic society, decrim nature in different spots. Those places can really tell you what's going on with your legislature or your movements in that spot. And there's a few different bills. It's either decriminalization to where it makes it, you know, to where it's not a criminal act to actually have psychedelics. Some research bills like what passed in Texas where the government is actually mandating that the VA there spend some funds to study psychedelics. And that's been happening in a few places, I think Oklahoma and Georgia, and then Oregon, which is a very novel sort of thing where they're actually trying to make a clinical model for first psilocybin. It might expand. I know Colorado is working on something on a statewide basis. So each place is starting to move it, even some of the most conservative spots, like I said, Georgia, Texas, Oklahoma. And so look in your local spot. There tend to be psychedelic communities there. Heroic Hearts itself has an ambassador program. And so whether you want to help us directly or kind of wanting to be involved with local initiatives, you can reach out to us and we kind of keep you updated with what's going on and how you can help.
Amazing. And because we're coming to our end, if you had one thing you want to say to the world just about your experience, about these medicines, one message before you leave this rock, what do you got for us?
The message I like to always keep is the psychedelic is the tool, and it can be a very powerful tool, but it's all about how you use it, right? And so I don't want people to get too focused on like this is going to change them, their world and everything. We have the power within ourselves and the psychedelic can really help, but we need to get back to a spot where we have communities, we have self-support, we have education to where we're responsible for our own mental health. We need to democratize mental health once again because it's come to the spot where it's bottlenecks with therapists, it's dependent on medications. But if you look at old tribes and societies, it wasn't the same sort of problem. And so that's what we all need to work together on. How do we all be more empowered to be better arbiters of our own mental health and have that community support to where I can depend on you, I can call you up anytime, and you can depend on me. And that is the key to this. Community is the key.
I love that. So we can empower each other to empower themselves to heal and to step outside of the box to find new and ancient tools for healing.
Absolutely. I'll say that Heroic Hearts Project, we are a 501c3 nonprofit, and so we do everything we do depends on the generosity and donations of others. Every vet costs about $4,000 to send through this. We have a huge waiting list, and so we really do need people's support to push this forward. And there's many ways to help out, whether it's volunteering or financial, but that's, you know, it makes the gears turn.
Amazing. Jesse, thank you so much. I mean, we love to have you on again. We're going to continue to support. Please, everybody, go to their website. If you know any vets that are struggling, please direct them towards this amazing foundation. It can help them find an alternative to their healing and their health. And yeah, brother, we all appreciate everything you're doing, man. Like, thank you so much. And it's so nice to finally get to connect after hearing about you for so many years.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. And like I said, this has come full circle. So it's an honor for me.
That's our show. Thank you for listening to the Awakened Underground podcast. We appreciate your time, attention, and support. Please be sure to hit the subscribe button. Throughout the season, we will be interviewing doctors, scientists, shamans, thought leaders, and celebrities who work with psychedelic medicines and are ready to come out from the underground to share their stories of healing with the world and what these medicines have to teach us about the true nature of reality. The Awakened Underground is a production of Calvary Audio in association with iHeartRadio. The Awakened Underground is created and hosted by Cody Blue, directed by Tanya Dahl, produced by Cody Blue and Jeff Apple, executive produced by Dana Burdetti and Keegan Rosenberger, co-executive produced by Jason Seagraves and Brandon Morgan, and a very special thanks to Danielle DeLoreto, Eric Klein, Alexander Chinisi, Armand Zadie, David Grillo of Thank You Plant Medicine, our teachers, First Nations people, our ancestors, our families, and these sacred plants.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.